Welcome, everyone. It's my pleasure to welcome Vojta Novotný among us, my former PhD advisor, who also happens to be a leading figure in the tropical ecology of today. He started humbly in the Czech Republic like 20 years ago or something like that, did his PhD there, but since then he sort of transferred his life to Papua New Guinea through the former Christensen Research Institute, which was about 15 years ago, and then established with collaborators his own research station, which has been in operation about 15 years, which is way more than the regular lifespan of a tropical research station, which I figure is like 3 years usually, one NSF funding period. And so today Vojta will tell us something about the accumulation of results they got about how the tropical forests really work and how they evolved, especially with a focus on insects.
And good afternoon, everybody. Thanks, Siri, for the introduction. It's a real pleasure to be on my first visit to Wisconsin and also visiting Siri, who I should specify, I was his first PhD supervisor because he has more than one PhD degrees, and he spent almost 2 years in Papua New Guinea and made an important contribution to the results which you will be seeing. Typically I should probably start going straight to hardcore science on food webs, but I feel like probably some general introduction about Papua New Guinea or New Guinea as an island is maybe timely here, because it's extremely interesting area for biologists as well as for those interested in social cultural diversity, and both biology and social aspects of life there heavily influence whatever biological research you want to do there. So it's actually relevant to what we do there and also how we do things there. There are some specific opportunities and specific difficulties which are associated with work and life in New Guinea. The island of New Guinea is one of the last three really huge areas of remaining tropical rainforest. So it's extremely important area for biological diversity. It has about 5% of the global biodiversity, and it's by and large still in a good state, in a good situation. So for biologists, it's a very good place to work because you don't see the subject of your studies disappearing in front of your eyes. However, it's even more important for cultural and linguistic diversity, because incredibly, Papua New Guinea harbors 20% of global linguistic diversity. It has about 1,000 different languages. The independent state of Papua New Guinea has about 700, and then the other part of the island, which is part of Indonesia, has 300. So these are boundaries of individual languages. Our field station is about here, and so that's the most linguistically diverse area on the planet. And for me as a biologist, of course, I expected to come and see a huge number of species, of plants, animals. That's not really surprising. Papua New Guinea there is right there with other tropical countries, not really exceptional in this regard. However, the linguistic diversity is incredible, because you can actually walk in one day through two or three different language areas. This is the distribution of population sizes of speakers of different languages, and it's on the logarithmic scale. So the typical population speaking a single language is about 1,000 people, and so the most common language in the whole country of Papua New Guinea is spoken by 4% of population. So this is a situation which is completely incredible. It has consequences for our field work. This is our field ecology course, and if we want to properly mark bathrooms, then this is what we do to make justice to all the languages spoken by our students, including the Czech language, of course. The linguistic diversity, of course, comes with cultural diversity. So this is also a country of many very different cultures. this is topic which is not really part of the seminar, but just to note that there are interesting parallels between cultural diversity of human populations and biological diversity. This is the global distribution of cultures, which are more or less defined by different languages. And you can actually see a lot of correlation in biological diversity. Also, you can predict fairly successfully cultural diversity in terms of languages or cultures per 100 square kilometers by the rainfall. That's what colleagues at the social science and anthropology departments don't like to hear, but actually rainfall is what defines not only cultures, but also the number of religions, for instance. That also works very well with rainfall. Papua New Guinea is also an interesting country in the sense that it's one of the more successful example of introduction of parliamentary democracy into post-colonial world. It does have its own problems, but by and large, it's a country with working parliamentary democracy and free press, so that's another aspect which makes it relatively pleasant to work there. I will conclude my introduction to Papua New Guinea by showing main lifestyles in that country. Okay, this is lifestyle number one. This is a floodplain of a huge tropical river, the Sitic River, and this landscape has been populated by people longer than Wisconsin and about the same length of time as Europe, 40,000 to 50,000 years. And yet, you don't really see a single mark of human presence in this landscape. All this is extremely dynamic landscape. The river changes its course by tens of meters every year. These lakes, they expand or contract by about 1,000 square kilometers depending on the rainfall. You can't really build any permanent structures there, any bridges. You can't develop substantial agriculture. So people there, they are subsisting on the river resources, fishing especially, and harvesting sago palms. Sago palm is a very common palm species which flowers and fruits only once in the lifetime. So for many years it accumulates starch as a source of energy in the trunk, and then you can actually filter it out and produce a staple food called sago. Interestingly, these populations live in complete superabundance of food. Yeah, that's what they have common with the United States of these days. And because these sago palms, they are everywhere. And one sago palm will supply enough food for 1 year, for one person. And so you don't really have to work too hard to get enough food. And so you would expect that these cultures will have enough time to develop culture, science, and so on. But in fact, they are one of the slowest in developing technology. As you can see, comparing their cutting edge technology from 1860 to 2003, not much progress has been made. Okay, lifestyle number two is in the lowland rainforests. That's what is most interesting for biologists. Because there are all these huge biodiversity, all these large rainforests, and again, we like to assume that people living there actually like it this way, and that's why they have all these rainforests, and that's why they are sort of natural conservationists who just needs to develop their sort of wishes and further conserve the forests, unless we come in and log it all over as a sort of external influence. Unfortunately, this is not really the case when you talk to the people there, and the reason why there are so many rainforests left in the lowlands is much more prosaic, and it's a malaria infection which is really dominant there. New Guinea is the country with the strongest transmission of malaria anywhere outside Africa. And malaria is a specifically human disease, so that if population goes up, then the transmission through mosquitoes is more efficient, then people start dying, population goes down. So malaria is really efficient factor controlling human populations, and that's why you have this strange pattern of population density, where in the altitudes from 0 to about 1500, where malaria is common, you have extremely low population, below 10 people per square kilometer. And the highest peaks are about 1500 to 2000 meters. So that's completely opposite to what we know from Northern America, from Europe, where of course the lowlands are, the fertile lowlands are most densely populated. The effect of malaria can be seen also in shaping genetic constitution of the human populations. The malaria, the Plasmodium parasite, attacks erythrocytes, and Papua New Guineans have huge variety of mutations of different building blocks of erythrocytes, which are physiologically harmful, but can protect you against malaria. And because malaria is such a strong mortality factor, it's actually make them advantages in the lowlands, but not in the high altitudes where malaria is not a problem, and it's also not a selection factor. So this is the list of all kinds of mutations which I'm not going to go into, but for instance, this one of alpha globin of the erythrocyte protein chains, which has 90% incidence in the lowlands. So 90% of people actually have this mutation. When you go 100 kilometers distance to the highlands, only 5% of people have it. So it's an example of strong selection pressure by malaria, and indeed it protects against severe malaria. So yeah, and we can continue like this with all other mutations. So malaria is a very strong factor which still limits populations, and especially limited them in the past. So how it looks like where there is no malaria? That's in the highlands. This is how the highland landscape looks like. And it's actually probably the landscape which most reflects the wishes of people living there, because there people are really in control of how the landscape look like. You have scattered settlement, you have farms, grasslands, plots of agricultural land, and some forest, most of it planted. This is the area which independently invented agriculture, so about 7,000 years ago. They plant casuarina tree, which is a nitrogen fixer. So they have sort of agroforestry practice there, and they have been inhabiting this country at relatively high density for thousands and thousands of years. And so that's probably what's the stable situation when you are not limited by a parasite. When I went on Google Images and type Wisconsin landscape, and the first image which came up is this one. When you compare it with the New Guinea highlands, it's more or less the same style of landscape. You know, it's again grasslands, agriculture fields, scattered settlement, clumps of trees, mostly planted. So these are sort of convergent ideas, which came basically, the settlement came to the same ideas about what kind of landscape they want to live. And this is not a new development. It's not Papua New Guineans getting ideas from US or Europe or Australia and copying it, because this is actually one of the last contacted areas in the world. In 1930, there were about 1 million people who had no idea about that they exist together with other people, that there are oceans somewhere. That was the last uncontacted population. And in 1932, Australian patrol officers made first contact with these people, and also Australians had no idea that there was 1 million people living in these highland valleys. And when this contact happened, the landscape looked pretty much the same as here. And at that time, this was shaped completely by stone tools. They didn't have any steel technology. So these are two really independent developments between the landscape, and they are remarkably convergent. And then the last lifestyle is this sort of knowledge-driven, research-oriented, highly technologically supported lifestyle, which in Papua New Guinea exists in about 10,000 square meter area, which coincides with our field station. And after this introduction, I'm going to basically describe what is the results of the research we have there. As Jiri mentioned, this is our field station on northern coast of New Guinea. This is the group of our field research assistants, which are a major force in our research, together with visiting researchers and PhD students who are recruited both from our American collaborators and my Czech group, and who typically spend about a year or more at the station. So, going back to the food webs. This is the concept of food web as seen by Papua New Guinean children actually living in the forest. And if you spend your lifetime of refining that concept and really studying hard, then you will come up with something like this. And I'm going to talk about food webs in sort of six chapters, which reflect what I think are the most promising approaches to the study of food webs. So let's start with phylogeny. I actually initially promised that this all will be about phylogeny, but that was more like advertisement, which is typically not really reflecting the reality. So we have only one chapter on this. This is a food web matrix where each column is one rainforest tree species and each row is one herbivorous insect. And the black marks are the documented trophic interactions between a certain herbivorous species and tree. Ideally, we would like to have a phylogenetic relationships between both trees and insects. Unfortunately, there are not so many food webs with this resolution available, and I am not aware of any really large one from tropical forests yet, but there is increasing number of food webs with good resolution for plants, and that's the case with our food web, where we have molecular phylogeny for tropical trees, and that permits us to ask some sort of phylogenetically oriented questions. For instance, how is the host specificity, the host range of individual herbivores mapping on plant phylogeny, whether it's clustered and limited to certain lineages or not. This is simply a refinement on the traditional way of counting a number of host plant species, host plant genera, families, and so on. It's more complicated to interpret these data than you would think, because whether something is significantly clustered or not depends on how many plants you actually involve in the comparison, and also on your sample size. But just for the sake of illustration, the yellow field, these are species, mostly grasshoppers, stick insects, which do not show any non-random selection of plants from the underlying phylogeny, while green field is significantly clustered species which are limited in their selection of host plants to certain lineages only. We can also look at the insect herbivores from the sort of community perspective, when we have a tree species which is colonized by certain set of herbivorous species. So you have something like herbivorous assemblage on that particular tree. And then you can see, if you have two tree species, you can look at how phylogenetically related they are. That can be expressed by the phylogenetic distance between these two trees. And then you can look at how much the species of herbivores feeding on this tree overlap. That can be expressed by simple Jacquard similarity, which indicates the proportional species which are shared between these two tree species. We have here 60 rainforest trees, and when you do pairwise comparison between each two of them, then not really surprisingly, you see that the overlap in the herbivorous communities is decreasing with increasing phylogenetic distance of these trees. The red comparisons are pairs of congeneric trees, so you can see that the traditional taxonomy is sort of reflected by molecular phylogeny, because these are the pairs with shortest phylogenetic distances. These are different genera from the same family, these are different families. However, what is interesting here, more than this significant relationship, is how poorly it predicts the composition of herbivores. There is actually only 44% of variability explained, and you see a huge scatter around these relationships. So that means if you have a pair of closely related tree species, it will still tell you very little about what will be the overlap of their herbivores. So there are obviously other aspects than phylogeny of plants, which is important in shaping herbivorous communities. Another example of how you can use plant phylogeny in study of their herbivores is our attempt to compare host specificity between temperate zone and tropical forests. This is Central European lowland floodplain forest, and this is lowland forest in New Guinea. It's fairly hard to compare meaningfully their food webs, because the three species which you find in Central Europe or Wisconsin for that matter are recruiting from completely different plant lineages than trees you find in tropical forest. In tropical forest we have Euphorbiaceae, Rubiaceae, all the families which you know from here as herbaceous species, they are woody in tropical forests. So it's really hard to compare them directly lineage by lineage, but what we try to do is to select the dominant three species from Central Europe, which there happen to be 14 of them, have the phylogeny for them, and then pick 14 tree species from rainforest in New Guinea, which have exactly the same branching of phylogeny and the same length of the branches in their phylogeny. So they are not from the same lineages. There is no connection between Alnus and Bimelodendron, which is from Euphorbiaceae, for instance, and or with these other connections. But when you look at the phylogenetical diversity as represented by the cladogram, then it's exactly the same. And so your two sets of trees have the same internal phylogenetical diversity, and then you can simply count the number of host species for herbivorous insects. And our conclusion is that when you standardize data like this, you do not have really any big differences between host specificity of temperate and tropical herbivorous species. Okay, now quantitative approach to food web analysis. These food web diagrams are copied from a number of books, and you would have a really hard time to recognize which are serious scientific works and which are children's book. Until recently, the food web concept was more or less the same. It's not so far ago when biologists started to take into account the quantitative aspects of the food web, meaning that different host plants, for instance, have different abundance in the field, which is expressed by the size of these blocks for the tropical trees. And the herbivores on them, again, have not only different abundance, but also when they feed on more than one plant species, that they can do that with very different frequency. This species actually this one is monophages and feeding only on this plant, but then there are species like this one which have more than one host, and when you look at the trophic interactions, there is a vast range of their frequency, from very, very dominant, very important ones to lots of very rarely occurring trophic interactions. You can do all kinds of assessments, evaluations, calculations with these quantitative food webs, where the frequency of the trophic link is usually expressed by the number of herbivorous individuals of certain species feeding on certain plant species. I'm not going to go into this in detail, but one example of such characteristics, which is sort of very easy to understand, is this. If you pick up an individual herbivore from your food web, then when you pick up another one from the same species, what is the probability that this second specimen will be from the same host plant as the first one? So that's what's called host plant isolation, meaning isolation in terms of their herbivores, how they connect, how the same species of herbivores can connect different plant species by feeding on more than one plant species. So there are plants which are really isolated, where this probability that another representative of that herbivorous species will be from the same plant is close to one. That's where the herbivores are monophages, and so they can't feed on any other plant. And then it, of course, can be also very low for the very generalist herbivorous assemblages, where each species is feeding on many other alternative plants, which means that whatever happens on one plant, for instance, large increase in number of herbivorous individuals, can influence other plants because these are shared in their hosts as the host plants of these herbivores. So these are data from again, our favorite lowland rainforest in New Guinea. Basically, with some simplification, we can say that there are some plants which are very well connected through their herbivores with others. Not surprisingly, that's mostly species which coexist with closely related plant species from the same genus in the forest. And then there are plants which are really isolated, where most of the herbivorous species feeding on them are monophages, and so these plants can't really share herbivores with others. And so these are mostly phylogenetically isolated plant species. When we are talking about plant herbivorous food webs, I should clarify for those who are not entomologists that there is not a single study anywhere in the tropical forests where the entire plant herbivorous food web is inventoried and known. Typically, entomologists are focusing on certain groups of insects, either taxa or guilds. And there are guilds which are more frequently studied and those which are less frequently studied. Leaf-chewing insects are the most popular ones. That doesn't necessarily mean they are most important ones. It's simply that these are easy to study. And so this is the composition of different published analyses from tropical forests by different insect guilds. So for instance, root-chewing insects are not very popular, and perhaps you can understand why compared with the ease of study of the leaf-chewing insects. So we wanted to look into different guilds to see whether if you study one guild, whether you are done and the others will give you similar patterns, or whether you really need to go guild by guild if you want to really understand the plant herbivorous food web. This is probably the best studied piece of rainforest anywhere in the world for plant herbivorous food webs. There are certain groups of insects, for instance Lepidoptera, which are studied better at some other places, in this case Dan Jensen's research in Costa Rica, but nowhere else there are such a variety of guilds covered from the same place. So I will go through briefly through different guilds. This is leaf chewers, caterpillars collected by New Guinea assistants and then reared on the plants from which they were collected. Each of these containers contains one caterpillar and then database identified and so on. This is the study of fruit feeding insects, again rearing. Tephritid flies is one example. There is also lots of other flies, beetles, especially curculionids, as well as moths. These are cerambycids. These sections of timber are exposed for beetles to oviposit, and then they are reared for 6 months in these cages, and whatever comes out of them is harvested. Okay, this is bark beetles. Here is study where you kill selected rainforest tree standing by ringing the bark and setting fire at its base. I think he really enjoyed doing that. And then the dying tree will attract bark beetles. Then you rear sections of branches and trunk in these boxes, and then you will get bark beetles. This is the root feeders. It's in the secondary forest where we could cut the surrounding trees and have only one focal tree, and then have these traps which would collect everything which is emerging from soil, then dig up the soil below the trap to confirm from which roots it came, mostly beetles. Leaf mining insects, very tiny caterpillars feeding inside of the leaves. Lepidoptera, sometimes beetles and flies. Sub-sucking insects, you have to rear them on live trees, so these are saplings of rainforest trees where the larvae are introduced and then the adults are harvested from them. And so finally, if you combine all these food webs from the same tree species, this is a small example of 9 tree species, 2 ficus, 1 artocarpus, which is the same family Moraceae, then it comes related family Euphorbiaceae and so on. Just visually you can see huge differences in both species richness and host specificity and the entire structure of the food webs. This has consequences for ecological interpretation of the data. This is the more traditional way of showing host specificity. This is the proportion of species which feed on only one plant family as opposed to more plant families. The whole entire range from 0 to 100% is possible for different guilds, and that of course is important when you consider whether there is a potential for apparent competition where plants can influence each other through shared herbivores, or whether there is a potential for the Jensen-Connell density-dependent effects on maintaining plant species richness, because that works only if you have your pests really specialized. It also has consequences for the very old question of how many species are there in tropical forests. When you look at a guild composition of a single tropical tree species, there is a large proportion of species which belong to adult leaf chewers, and then caterpillars come second and so on. But if you extrapolate to, let's say, 100 different tree species, the relative diversity of guilds changes, because these leaf chewers, they are generalists. So when you keep adding new species of trees, you are getting more or less the same adult leaf chewers, and so their relative importance is decreasing, while more specialized insects, leaf miners, some leaf-sucking hemipterans and caterpillars, they are specialized. So with every new tree, you get new species which are specialized to the tree, and so their relative importance is increasing. When we put all this data together, we were able to estimate, not really collect and document, but estimate that on 200 tree species in that tropical forest which you saw, which is what is approximately there, we can expect 9,500 species of herbivorous insects, which are involved in 50,000 plant herbivorous interactions. So that's fairly complex plant herbivorous food web. This is how it looks when you plot a tiny part of that food web. This is only 38 tree species, and these are only herbivorous species feeding on leaves. From adult leaf chewers through sap-sucking insects to larval leaf chewers. So this is still only a small part of the food web. And then of course this is just first stage where you document something, you inventory something. But then you can start asking questions. For instance, what will happen to the food web if you somehow selectively remove this trophic link? And that's what we don't know. Okay, now I'm coming to from sort of community-oriented description of food webs to something which is sort of more methodological, and where I want to just show one what we think is an interesting approach to study of the tropical forest, but for which we don't have any solid results yet. Of course, the rainforests are famous for being inaccessible to biologists. Because most of the action is in the canopy. And it was, it's called the last frontier and so on. One reason why tropical forests are so difficult to study is that you can't really go to the canopy and study what is there. And there is a number of methods, canopy cranes, canopy raft, which is positioned by hot air balloon, special single rope climbing and so on. But relatively few biologists use a much more obvious method, and that is, if the canopy is too high for you, why not to cut down the trees and bring the canopy down to the ground and then study it at your convenience? And so that's what we did. This is an example where you can use a special New Guinea situation, which is one of the places where you can actually do that without harming the rainforest. Most of the local people are living in the rainforests, and they are slash and burn agriculture farmers. So they are cutting this kind of food gardens in the forest, approximately 1 hectare in size. You can see a mixture of plants. This is sugarcane, bananas, tapioca, and so on. And then they are harvesting the gardens. So we made a deal with one village that we will cut this garden for them and study the canopy in the process. And they will be helping us as field assistants. And so this is how it looks when biologists cut down tropical rainforest. This is the initial primary rainforest. This is when you remove all the understory plants. This is when you cut down all trees below 10 centimeters in diameter. And this is when you cut down all the trees. So that was an opportunity for us to really inventory the structure of the forest. We picked the leaves, all the leaves from all the trees. Every tree was measured. The leaves were weighted. Then we subsampled the leaves. This is the subsampling, statistically important subsampling procedure. And digitally photograph the leaves from the subsample so that we have the leaf area and also the damage done by herbivores. Then we also collected insect larvae. Of course, adults would fly away, but we collected insect larvae from all the leaves. And so finally, and that's the huge amount of data which we are still working on, we will have three-dimensional structure of the trees, their leaves, and the insects feeding on them. So this is actually real data from our study. This is 0.2 hectare from the 1 hectare we have in total. These are individual trees reconstructed. We can do them by different tree species and genera, and also we can, with the precision to the nearest tree, we can plot all the ant nests, we can plot all the leaf mining insects. This is the density of leaf miners per 1 kilogram of the foliage for every individual tree there. We can plot them by individual leaf mining species. This software is dynamic, so if you want to have some fun, you can sort of virtually walk into the canopy and then look what different herbivores and species are there. But as I say, this is just something which we will be working this year on, and we don't have any real solid data on the structure. And finally, the village community was very happy about the whole research project, because from 1 hectare of their garden, they were able to earn $50,000 in salaries, basically, because this whole procedure, it took us 2 years. And we were at six days every week, except for Christmas, and there were 8 our staff, research technicians, and 15 villagers working on this. So, gives you an idea of the scale. This is another aspect of food web beta diversity, and that is that, of course, if you work in a place like Barro Colorado Island, then the limits of your food webs are pretty obvious, but again, if you work in New Guinea, you develop this mindset of working in a huge continuous tropical forest, and so you of course wonder what is the beta diversity, not only of species, which is a typical sort of long-standing biological question, but also what is the beta diversity of food webs, which can be decomposed into turnover of plant species, herbivore species, and also trophic interactions. We studied, among other things, also forests at different altitudes. These are two very different forests at 100 meters and 1800 meters. They are almost completely different, but still there are few species of trees which are shared between these two different habitats. Most of them are ficus, fig trees. And this goes to illustrate all kinds of scenarios you can have when comparing food webs from different habitats. For instance, this is Azota noctuid, which was present at both sides, but it jumped from a lowland species of ficus to another one which was restricted to the highlands. So the same morph, different hosts. This is an example of the same blue butterfly which fed on lowland ficus only in the lowlands, then jumped on widely dispersed ficus, which was present in the lowlands as well as in the highlands, but the butterfly ignored it in the lowlands, probably as a substandard food, but since the favorite species was not in the highlands, then it had to jump on that second species. Single case of one species continuously present throughout the lowlands and highlands for both plant and its herbivore, and then another example of widely distributed host plant, but herbivorous insect, Euploa butterfly, which was only limited to the lowlands. So you can have all kinds of scenarios. So when you are comparing two food webs, you can see which trophic interactions are shared between two food webs. So this is the example of 4 herbivorous species feeding on 3 plants in 2 habitats, and then by simple comparison, you can see that this is the only trophic interactions which is shared. 2 herbivore species are shared, 1 plant species is shared. And then all these other trophic interactions, they do exist in one of these food webs, but they are not shared. Why they are not shared? Because either plant species are not, the plant species involved is not in, in both food webs, or herbivore species is not in, in both of them, or both plant and herbivore species are not there, or as in this case, plant species and herbivore species are there, but the trophic interaction is not there. So you can actually decompose the beta diversity into these different scenarios, and then when you look at what's happening in the field, then you can have the overall beta diversity decomposed into these four different elements. This is our study of 8 different study sites in the lowland tropical forest across 500 kilometers distance, where we have the pairwise comparison of these 8 sites. This is the logarithm of the distance. And as you can expect, overall beta diversity of, in this case, Lepidoptera feeding on Makaranga species, Makaranga is a secondary forest small tree, was increasing with distance between the sites. But the different elements of this beta diversity were really changing with distance as well. At the short distance, the main reason for beta diversity was difference in the herbivorous communities, while with increasing distance, the importance of plant turnover was dominant. Okay, and I will conclude with another sort of methodological chapter where we don't have results, but still I find it sufficiently interesting to talk about this. With these food webs, of course, description is the first step, but because they are so complex, the only way how you can really understand what's going on is some kind of experiment, some kind of way how to sort of poke the food web and, you know, disturb it and see what's going to happen. This is not a new concept, and there is a lot of experiments. But in tropical forests, you have a choice. You either do a very simple, very controlled experiment which involves maybe few plants and few herbivorous insects, and the interpretation is very straightforward, but you are addressing a very small section of that food web. So then you are left with the question of how relevant is your little experiment to entire food web. Or you can have a large scale experiment which somehow changes the entire food web, but then you have a potentially a problem that you will not know what this means, what's actually going on. There has been a lot of these small scale experiments which are very valuable way of studying food webs, but there are few really large scale experiments. There are some, for instance, manipulating rainfall for the forest by covering large areas of the rainforest floor with plastic sheets and draining all the water. So that's an example of large scale experiment, but not so much with insects. So we decided to do such a large scale experiment, again taking advantage of what's possible in New Guinea. And so the question we want to address is that what's going to happen if you remove all ants from lowland rainforest? Why we ask this question? Because again, for a temperate zone entomologist, if you come to a tropical forest, perhaps the most striking difference is huge number of ants. Huge abundance of ants on vegetation. If you place some food items for ants on the leaves, then it can take minutes before they are discovered by ants. And so there is obviously very strong predation pressure by ants on tropical foliage. And so the question is how it's shaping the communities. So we have decided to try to remove ants. And when we ask our other biologists what's going to happen, nobody actually knows. You know, you can either have explosion of herbivorous insects, or you can have compensation by birds. Somebody suggested spiders. Somebody suggested increased parasitism. Somebody said, well, ants are not only predators, but they also have mutualism with hemiptera ants, and so that will complicate the whole picture. So we don't know. Anyway, this is another part of the forest which is destined to become a garden. But before it was cut down, we use it as a pilot experiment to plot. This is one from the primary forest. We had another one from secondary forest, and then control plots. So this is not replicated. This is just sort of proof of the concept, where we try to remove all ants or as many ants as possible from the above ground foliage. how we did that? We used tuna baits. These are constructed so that ants will go inside, but flying insects will not be able to access the bait inside. And the tuna bait is, in some traps, it's clean just for monitoring the ant activity. In some cases, it's poisoned with fipronil, which is a powerful insecticide. We plan, after this initial poisoning, to replace it with juvenile hormone analogs, which are completely harmless for insects, unless you feed them to developing larvae, because then it stops their development. And that's exactly what ants do. They will bring this to their nests and feed their larvae there. But that remains to be seen. However, we tested the ability, our ability to poison the ants, but nothing else in the forest. You have to isolate this forest. You have to cut all the lianas so there are no bridges in the canopy. You have to isolate it with insect glue. This is the secondary forest plot. Of course, the ants can still fly inside, but that's why you have to repeat your poisoning in certain intervals. This is ant activity in the control plots, in the canopy, and in the treatment plots. So we were able to keep ants at about 20% of their initial activity for more than half a year. So it does work. However, for 1 hectare, which will be our experimental size, we will need 7,000 of these traps. So it's a fairly large exercise. Luckily, New Guineans know how to climb trees. Different ants responded differently, but I'm not going to go to these details because I think I'm running out of time. So I will conclude the whole seminar with just noting that in New Guinea, if you do field ecology, you inevitably also work in social networks, which are really important for your work, which can work to your benefit, but also in many cases, as Jiri mentioned, the lifespan of research projects there is fairly short, and it's because biologists often make mistakes on the social front rather than on the biological front. So this is the entire community of Wanang village where we did all these experiments with cutting down the forest and ant eradication. And this is our team of research technicians, which now has 18 members, plus some Papua New Guinea resident students and overseas students. And this, I just put this is not directly relevant because this is a medical student, but this is a graduation ceremony, and this is a Tari traditional costume, and I just noted that you had a little controversy in the States where Tea Party used Obama's picture as an African witch doctor, which was actually dressed in this traditional Tari costume, who saw the picture. And then this is the example of logistical difficulties which the country certainly offers plenty. And needless to say, this is a hugely collaborative project. These are all the researchers, postgraduate students, research technicians or parataxonomists, and about 200 research assistants employed at one stage or another. Some of our New Guinea collaborators are here. Thank you for your attention. I suppose we have 5 minutes for questions, or
yes.
Yeah, okay, please.
Sometimes it's hard to identify, you know, to the species level in the tropics. How do you get around that, and who identifies all the species?
Yes, it's a big problem. One of our key collaborators is Scott Miller at the Smithsonian, who has a huge network of collaborating taxonomists. That's mostly for Lepidoptera. So these are distributed, but that's for the taxonomic identification, that's for the naming of the species. But the first step is to sorting them into species concepts, into morphospecies, and that has to be done on a really professional level. So we have taxonomists checking this, and recently we found barcoding to be very useful in this, pointing to cases of cryptic species. So we, in collaboration with Paul Hebert, we do fairly large-scale barcoding of species, especially in the groups where cryptic species are likely to be. For instance, I didn't mention our study on parasitoids. That's an example where more than 95% of species are taxonomically unknown and morphologically very, very uniform. So it's a big problem, but it has to be dealt with. And ideal combination of taxonomic expertise and ecological expertise is not always available, but that's what ideally be needed.
I have a question regarding your networks. I suspect that the networks are based on a matrix of yes or no associations, which I happen to know it's based on something like 90% of individuals found on that plant is a specialist or something like that. But I'm wondering, to what extent are you able to include the preference, not just yes or no feeding on that plant, but also some plants are highly preferred over others, some plants are occasionally exploited, but not quite often. This sort of more gradual preference rather than just yes or no feeding, non-feeding.
Yes, on the individual level, for an individual herbivore, we always basically included that individual herbivore in our matrix based on whether it was feeding on that plant or not, whether we found it there or not. On the species level, the numbers of individuals serve as an index of their preference. Yeah, we assume that this species with 5 and 5 shows more or less equal preference for the plants. So. Yes, in one case we did preference experiments on individual herbivores, and there can be even individual herbivores of the same species can have different preferences towards different plants. But this is the level which we don't really address. We basically start on species level, so the relative preference of a certain herbivore species to different plants is reflected by the population size on these individual plants.
There are no more questions, I think.